Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, the next chancellor of the State Center Community College District. And later, restored classical instruments that survived the Holocaust are part of an upcoming Fresno State concert. But first, California rules meant to protect outdoor workers from the dangers of wildfire smoke are almost never enforced. That's the finding of an investigation by KQED and the California Newsroom. Farida Jobvila Romero reports from Fresno on the latest in our ongoing series, Dangerous Air.
Breathing wildfire smoke can lead to serious health problems like worsening asthma and heart failure. So when there's unhealthy levels of wildfire smoke, California employers are required to reduce exposure, such as by moving workers indoors or providing N95 masks. But in Fresno, the state's top producing agricultural county, many farm workers I spoke with say they've continued to work in heavy smoke with no protections. In a field by the highway, a man pulls dry grapevines from the soil. He's worked in U.S. agriculture for 15 years. I hand him a wrapped N95 mask and ask if his boss ever offered him one.
No, 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 no. En el trabajo no nos han dado ni máscaras para nada, en ningún trabajo.
No, at work they haven't given us masks at all, he says. We're not using his name because he says he fears retaliation from his employer. And like more than 40% of the state's ag workers, he's undocumented. An estimated 4 million people work outdoors in California. Over the last 2 years the rule's been in place, the state has faced the worst wildfire seasons on record. But the agency tasked with protecting workers' safety cited employers for violating the smoke rules just 11 times. That's according to data obtained by KQED and the California Newsroom. The official who was in charge of enforcement at Cal OSHA just got a bigger job as head of federal OSHA.
Testimony. Senators will each have 5 minutes for a round of questions. Before we begin,
during his Senate confirmation hearing this spring, Doug Parker told lawmakers a top priority is to enforce worker safety laws.
And then we also have to be able to deliver the goods once those workers have the trust in us to come forward.
He declined to speak with KQED and directed us to Dan Lucido, who's now the acting chief of Cal OSHA.
We are a leader in providing worker protection, including against smoke.
Do you really believe that there's only 11 violations of this law over 2 years?
So first of all, we can only respond to complaints that are issued. And in all of the cases where we responded and found evidence of a violation, we issued a citation.
Back in the field in Fresno, the worker says he didn't know about the rule, so he couldn't complain about not getting the required protections. His employer never told him how to stay safe on smoky days, he says. Other farm workers I talked to said the same thing. And that's something the rule says employers must also do in a language workers understand. Can-Do Ag Management employs workers in this field.
So we already sent over your email to our attorney, so he is the one that's going to be responding.
Angie Garcia works at Can-Do Ag Management. I contacted her after sending a request for comment.
We provide everything necessary for them to, you know, use while they're working.
Later, the attorney told KQED the company is in compliance with the smoke safety rules, but declined to provide any evidence. What's really needed, advocates and state lawmakers say, are strike teams of Cal OSHA inspectors in the fields on smoky days. But a bill to do just that was gutted in the state legislature earlier this year, after Governor Gavin Newsom's administration opposed it. In Fresno, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
Farida will have more on that reform proposal and the pushback from the Newsom administration in just a minute. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As you've just heard, KQED's Farida Javala Romero has been investigating the state's failure to enforce regulations meant to protect farm workers and others exposed to wildfire smoke. She found that earlier this year, lawmakers tried to boost enforcement, but Governor Gavin Newsom's administration stepped in and blocked their efforts.
At a food bank in the town of Biola in Fresno County, volunteers help Alejandra Beltran load groceries into cardboard boxes and carry them to her pickup truck.
What does it need?
Beltran is a farm worker. This fall, she worked in the fields harvesting grapes for raisins, she says, including shifts and thick wildfire smoke.
Personally, me, it affects me on my, you know, my chest. And I get very, like, a hoarse voice, and then produces a lot of cough.
Tiny particles in wildfire smoke can trigger asthma attacks, strokes, and other serious health problems. Since 2019, California employers have been required to protect workers when smoke levels become unhealthy by offering them N95 masks, for example, or moving them indoors. But farm workers like Beltran told us they never heard about those regulations. She says she never got an N95, nor the training employers are supposed to give workers about the health hazards of smoke.
As far as my knowledge, we weren't told anything.
An estimated 4 million Californians work outdoors. But data obtained by KQED and the California Newsroom show that over the more than 2 years the smoke regulations have been in place, the state dispatched inspectors to only 26 employers. That led to just 11 citations for violations of the wildfire smoke standard.
11 violations, you know, obviously is a very low number.
California Assemblyman Robert Rivas chairs the Assembly's Agriculture Committee. He introduced a bill that would have required the government to send strike teams of inspectors to the fields whenever smoke levels become dangerous.
Having a mechanism of enforcement is incredibly important.
But the provision was deleted last summer, after opposition from Governor Gavin Newsom's administration. That's according to internal documents we viewed and interviews with people close to the negotiations.
You know, my effort here was not trying to penalize growers in any way and, you know, or the agricultural industry, but it was to, you know, achieve a level of accountability.
Governor Newsom's press office did not respond to multiple requests for comment. And neither did his Labor and Workforce Development Agency, which documents show wanted the strike teams removed. Dan Lucido did talk to us. As acting chief of Cal OSHA, she's in charge of enforcing the smoke rules. She also didn't want to comment on the changes to the bill.
To the extent that any amendments were made, it would have been the author's decision to amend the bill, not ours.
Lucido says her agency is a leader in providing worker protections, including against wildfire smoke. She says Cal OSHA is not opposed to sending strike teams out on smoky days. She acknowledged they've been short on outreach and blamed the pandemic. But now she says the agency is trying to get the word out about the smoke regulations, like through this video in English and Spanish posted on their website.
In California, el humo de los incendios puede afectar a los lugares de trabajo que se encuentran.
But many farm workers say they still don't know about the protections. So the rule's not working, says Nayamin Martinez. She directs the Central California Environmental Justice Network.
I always find it very ironic when the agencies brag about, oh, we have the most stringent rules in the entire nation. Well, you can have rules, but if you don't enforce them, then there's nothing good out of them.
Martinez's organization surveyed more than 300 farm workers in San Joaquin Valley earlier this year. Nearly 60% reported that their employers did not provide N95 masks or that they did not know what N95s were. In Fresno, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Earlier this week, Fresno City College President Carol Goldsmith was named the next chancellor of the State Center Community College District. In this new role, she will oversee the community colleges serving Clovis, Reedley, Madera, and Fresno. I spoke with her about the challenges facing these colleges in light of the pandemic and the future of the district. So just to start, full disclosure here, I do teach journalism at Fresno City College, so I am a member of the educational community that you lead. So I just want to be transparent about that fact. But one of the things that I preach to my students often is that when you're interviewing someone, don't be afraid to ask seemingly stupid questions. So I'm going to practice what I preach right now here off the top and ask you a really stupid question. So I think it's pretty easy for the average person to appreciate what a college president does and how a college president could shape a campus. But when we get to the chancellor level, it becomes a little bit more vague. So can you explain what you will be doing in this new role and how the vision you set as chancellor will translate into change in the classroom?
First of all, Kathleen, thanks for having me today. I'm really pleased that I got to have the opportunity to do this interview with you. And you know what? There are no stupid questions. So thank you for reminding all the listeners, many of whom are probably students, you need to ask the question you need to know. So what does a chancellor do? Well, that's a great question. And it's kind of like a college president, although it's a little different. So let me share with you. As chancellor, I work with the board to make sure the four colleges have the support that they need to be able to serve the communities we serve. And what that means is I'll be working with the board to help set policy and procedures, to oversee the budget, and to also work together to create perhaps new processes and new policies and advocate in Sacramento and in Washington to perhaps change some rules or to advocate for more resources for our community colleges and our community college students. So being a college chancellor, it's a greater responsibility. There's a fiduciary responsibility for not one college, but now four colleges and a district to support those four colleges. It's making sure that the community members know that the four colleges are vibrant and thriving. It's empowering and working alongside with those four college presidents to ensure that the board policies are enacted, that the college mission is being supported, and that our governance process is following the processes that we've put forward as it is in our accreditation. It's also being kind of the public voice for the district and working with the community. You know, and you've heard me say this, Kathleen, the first word in our business is community. We are a community college district. So a person from the Valley, I have an understanding and a great love for our community. You know, I know our communities are diverse and rich in cultural history, and yet our counties and our communities continue to struggle with economic disparities, access to housing or healthcare and unemployment, and even broadband, as this pandemic has shown us. In fact, you probably know this, but 38% of Fresno and Madera households don't earn enough to meet the basic. Data doesn't lie. And when you look into the data more deeply, it's more pronounced for communities of color. For example, in Fresno and Madera County, 65% of our Black families and 51% of our Latino families are struggling. And our Asian Americans, who make up the third largest demographic in our area, face similar disproportionate poverty. So what that means in terms of what does that mean? It means over 150,000 local families are struggling to get by day to day. And as chancellor, I believe, and as president, I believe, and I know this sentiment is echoed in many of our educators, you know, community colleges really is the greatest opportunity for change for the course of these 150,000 families to change their life, their fortune, and really the future of the San Joaquin Valley residents. So I believe State Center Community College District really plays a pivotal role in changing and shaping the lives of individual families and improving the communities. So as chancellor, it'll be my job to make sure that we stay on point, we stay on mission, because we know that we're just experiencing so much right now, our communities and our challenges stand a greater chance of resolution with a well-educated citizenry. And that's our job, educate tomorrow's nurses and firefighters, and just really make sure that we can have the colleges at State Center hold the promise to be that resolution to many of the problems that we face as a valley.
Sure. So I do want to ask more about your specific vision for the district moving forward. But before we get there, let's look back on the last couple of years as you were serving as president of Fresno City College. Obviously, it was an incredibly challenging time. You know, the pandemic has changed all of us in different ways, and we've all learned things about ourselves and about our community. I'm wondering, did the experience of leading the college through such a difficult period reveal anything to you, particularly about being a leader?
It's a great question. And absolutely. And I would say so many of us in education and actually in every profession learn so much about ourselves and the organizations we serve and the communities we live in. And what I learned while through this leading this very complex organization, which is Fresno City College, are a lot of the things I'm going to take with me as chancellor. And for me, it really brought home something that I knew, but it resonates so well, is that our greatest strength can be found when we work together and have the opportunity to come together and communicate more frequently. And those seem very simple, but you know, so often people in leadership get caught up in thinking that they have to solve everything. And as the leader, you often have to make decisions, but the real power and strength is working together. That caring communication, that, you know, having open forums, it's that time to listen and to really be able to give people the chance to take on additional responsibility and even have some autonomy. So for me, those moments of allowing people a little bit more autonomy and listening and coming up with a plan together, you can go much further together than you can as solo. And as we continue to work through the pandemic, our recovery continues to stay focused on the people. Our students remain the number one priority. Our faculty remain a priority. Our classified professionals, their success and our ability to learn is really tied to the future of our valley in this district.
Well, as you step into that new position, what do you believe are the greatest challenges facing the Central Valley's community colleges? And what is your vision to address those issues?
And there's a lot of challenges that we have, you know, and oftentimes you hear about people talking about the first 100 days in office. And a lot of times, especially when you have new people coming to a new job, you hear about, you know, going on listening tours. And while I also pledge to listen, I'm also very committed to action during my first 100 days. And so I've been looking at and tooling with and talking with people about this idea of a blueprint for recovery. And it really talks about how we can improve our culture and advance our trajectory for all of the colleges. Because we know Fresno City College is one of the largest colleges in the Valley, but State Center Community College District with four colleges, that is a huge economic engine. So I know that we're going to have to do some work to be able to continue to have opportunities for our students so we can continue our record-breaking graduation rates at each of the colleges. So one of my first priorities will be to focus on each of the colleges and their recovery efforts, to be able to amplify the message of outreach and that education is something that will improve your life. So my job will be able to will really be focused on supporting the four colleges and their efforts to focus on the students and the enrollment recovery. We must focus on our efforts to get students back, especially our young men. We have seen a disproportionate drop of our young men across the state. And we know that many of our working adults have lost their job and need help to retool to be competitive in the job market. So we're going to continue to focus on bringing those students back. My second, and really probably it's number one and two, they're both tied intrinsically, is to accelerate our progress in addressing systemic inequalities. Diversity, equity, and inclusion must be at the center of everything we do at the colleges and at the district. And I believe our colleges are on a great path for this. That's why that we see some of our college going rates are improving and our graduation rates continue, but we know that our area has some of the highest poverty rates in the nation. So we have to stay focused on accelerating our diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. So as chancellor, I'm hoping to set up a new steering committee that'll look at how we can better support the colleges so we can address the challenges, because the economic outlook and education are undeniably tied together. So the colleges of State Center, I believe, are the avenue to prosperity for our valley. So that's going to be my second priority. And then third, as you could probably already see, I'm going to bravely advocate for our colleges in Sacramento and Washington and our philanthropic groups across the nation to invest more in our colleges. We have such a powerful story. We transform lives of more than 65,000 students. So we have a real concern here in California. We talk a lot about equity, but I believe until we have equity and funding, our efforts are going to be very thwarted in our ability to really come to fruition. And this is not to say to take away money from any of our educational partners, but there's something amiss in California. There's four educational sectors, and we're the lowest reimbursed in the state. Let me give you an idea. Last year, the CSUs received over $33,000 per student for full-time. The CSUs received a little over $19,000 per student. The K-12s were reimbursed over $12,000. And the community colleges, well, we were reimbursed just over $9,000 per student. There's something amiss there. And costs are very much the same as everyone else's. Our PG&E bills are just like everyone else's. So that's something that I'm going to continue to work with people in Sacramento and others to see if there's a way we can have real economic equity as well as equity in other areas of our lives. Because we know that until we have funding equity, it's going to be difficult for us to be able to reach some of the goals we have.
And then what is the timeline for naming an interim president at Fresno City College?
You know, we're having those conversations now. As you know, they've made the announcement that I'm the chancellor. It becomes official once the contract is signed and approved at the December 14th board meeting. So the real question becomes, in academia, oftentimes it takes over a year to replace someone. I have also seen other academic institutions go on a little shorter trajectory and do something, say, in 6 to 8 months. So I'm hoping we might be able to do it a little sooner than the traditional norms, because we know that Fresno City College, because it's such a large institution, being able to have that stability is going to be really key for us to move forward. We have a lot of forward momentum. We want to keep that. So whoever will be the interim, that will be their job, is also not just to keep the seat warm, if it will, but to keep that forward momentum going. So it's going to be pivotal that we have steadfast leadership soon.
One last question before I let you go.
Sure.
I have to ask you about the political climate that we're all living through. You know, to be fair, politics have always been active in public education, but the extent to which national politics and identity politics are being injected into conversations about what should or should not take place in the classroom has reached a new level. And, you know, in an op-ed that was published in the Fresno Bee last year, you said that it's time for educators to re-examine our mission, that we need to practice grace and civility in the classroom and outside of the classroom. But how do we get there in such a fractured environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one that the entire nation is struggling with. And I'm going to go back to that basic premise that it's an individual choice to practice grace and civility. Individuals are going to want be the ones who are making these changes. You know, education, it really has been in the center of a lot of debate lately. And before, it was such a nonpartisan topic, and it's becoming more partisan. And yet you look at the challenges that we have just here in the Central Valley. And I truly believe education is the one vehicle that can really make a great difference for all of us. And I believe all of these challenges stand a greater chance of resolution with a well-educated citizenry. So with that said, each individual person involved in education, each one of us must practice grace and civility. And we may not agree. In fact, we probably won't, and that's okay. But we can't take it to the DEFCON 4, you know, where everything is high alert. It's okay to have disagreements. In fact, it's healthy to have disagreements. And we may not agree, but perhaps we can find common ground. And I keep going back to the common ground that we all can agree on is that we want our children to have better lives. We want our community to be healthier. We want to have our community be a place where people can thrive and reach their divine inspired potential. And that goes a long way to how we can communicate with one another. So the answer to that, I don't know if there is a single answer other than just looking at ourselves and saying, I choose today to be kind. I choose today to listen. And if someone doesn't like my viewpoint, that's okay. But I'm still going to continue to work with them and work for their families and work for their students to be productive and healthy and well-educated.
Well, I've been talking with Dr. Carol Goldsmith, the president of Fresno City College and the incoming chancellor of the State Center Community College District. Dr. Goldsmith, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Kathleen, and thanks to all the listeners for supporting our public radio station. Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. If you don't work in agriculture, groundwater sustainability may sound like an abstract issue. But in a series of recent letters from the state to local water agencies, one key message, the need to consider non-ag interests like drinking water and sinking land when making groundwater plans for the future. Here to talk about these letters and the latest in the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, known as SGMA, is KVPR's Carrie Klein. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
So we've been over this before, but can you remind us briefly what SGMA is?
Yeah, so it's this suite of laws passed in 2014 to prevent overpumping of groundwater. Historically, groundwater usage was not monitored, so anyone with a well could pull unlimited water out of the ground. But in dry years, there's so much pumping that the water table is falling, leaving many wells dry, as we see time and again, especially in Tulare County. And we're also facing subsidence, sinking of the land, which puts infrastructure like canals at risk. So the goal of SGMA is that by 2042, all basins in the state will be monitored and managed so that there is no more overdraft.
And the state did this by handing control of groundwater over to local water agencies.
Yeah, that's right. So the state drew up maps of all of its water basins, then allowed water users in those areas to coalesce into their own locally run water agencies. Those are known as GSAs, and there are nearly 350 of them across the state. All GSAs then had to put together their own sustainability plans that detail how they'll manage groundwater for the next 20 years. And in this area, those plans were all due to the state 2 years ago for review.
Okay, so that was 2 years ago. What's happening now?
Now, the State Department of Water Resources is finally coming back with feedback on those plans, approving them or not. So far, DWR has only reviewed 12 of those plans. Four of them are in the San Joaquin Valley, and none of those four have been approved just yet. They all have more work to do and have a very quick turnaround time to do it.
So tell me more about these plans. Where are they, and how did the state find them deficient?
So the four plans reviewed so far in our area are in the northern part of the valley. One in Stockton is outside of our reach at KVPR, but the closer ones are from eastern Merced County, western Madera County, and the west side of Fresno and Kings counties. Together, these agencies cover about 2,000 square miles and account for hundreds of thousands of irrigated acres and more than 2 million acre-feet of water just for agriculture. So they are very important to the groundwater landscape. And there are some common threads in the deficiencies that the state found in their plans. One of the big ones is that the state didn't feel these plans will adequately protect water quality or keep wells from running dry. For instance, the West Side Subbasin in Fresno and Kings counties allows for as many as 25% of its wells to run dry before so-called undesirable results occur. Many other plans actually give similar thresholds for wells running dry. I spoke about this and other issues with Paul Goslin. He's a deputy director with the Department of Water Resources and the head of the office reviewing these plans. And he said this particular point is concerning.
What we'd want is to have them analyze better how they believe that any number of wells going dry without any mitigation measures could be considered not significant and unreasonable.
Among other issues, these plans were also dinged for not adequately addressing sinking land and the damage that that can cause.
Those sound like pretty substantive deficiencies. Is the state water official you spoke to concerned about what he's seen in these plans so far?
Well, one thing that Paul Goslin told me is that enough plans had issues with guaranteeing drinking water that his office actually plans to write some guidance documents for GSAs on how to mitigate drinking water impacts, like wells running dry or contamination creeping in. Even so, he said he's actually quite optimistic for how this process has rolled out so far.
The plans that came in 2020, they had a relatively short amount of time to pull together plans in very complicated basins. So the fact that we have agencies formed covering basins and plans submitted that, have a lot of good direction and programs getting developed is very encouraging.
And how are the water agencies themselves responding to their comment letters?
So I didn't hear back in time from the two GSAs in Madera and Merced counties, but I did get to speak to Shelley Cartwright of Westlands Water District, which manages the Westside Subbasin GSA. She assured me that their plan does avoid, these quote-unquote undesirable results and that drinking water is a concern for their area. For instance, she says that if drinking water issues crop up later that weren't included in the original plan, they'll rewrite it to include them. However, she and the state don't seem to agree on how many community wells there are in her district. She believes the state has some outdated well information. And this is part of why this process is so complicated. Groundwater involves so many moving parts, and the amount of information in these plans is dizzying. I mean, the plan that Westlands alone put together is 1,900 pages long, and there are more than 300 of these from around the state. And in fact, Cartwright argued that most of the information the state is asking for is in their plan already. They just need to rewrite it more clearly. One big issue, of course, is time. The state has given them only until January to address these deficiencies in their plan, which is known as a GSP.
Obviously, it's going to take a lot of staff time to get this across the line. Whether it's overly burdensome, the holidays makes any task a little bit more difficult. But, I think the district is hopeful that we'll be able to accomplish this and get the GSP to a place in January where DWR is comfortable with our descriptions.
She says what the state has asked for is doable.
So you reported a few years ago that many drinking water advocates were concerned communities at risk of dry wells or contaminated water would be left out of the SGMA conversation. What do these decisions from the state reveal about this situation?
Well, I put those questions to Amanda Monaco with the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, and she says she's encouraged by the attention that DWR has paid to drinking water issues in their letters to water agencies so far.
The DWR analysis was a step in the right direction, clearly signaling that drinking water is important. Drinking water needs must be prioritized when we're thinking about how we manage our collective water resources, that water shouldn't just be seen as an input for economic production.
She hopes that these letters will get GSAs to reframe water as essential for quality of life and not just the economy. However, she's concerned about how much leeway DWR still appears to be giving these agencies. For instance, the state might still approve of a GSA that allows, say, 10% of its wells to go dry, if it explains its reasoning well enough. And her organization is having regular conversations with DWR to try to keep that from happening.
So what comes next? What's the timeline for fixing these plans and continuing with SGMA?
So DWR's letters right now are preliminary, and their final determinations will come down in January. That's when they decide if these plans are approved or incomplete. And after that, if those plans are still found to be incomplete, water agencies will have 6 months to fix them. And after that, if they're still inadequate, state officials will actually take control of the agency until the plan is rewritten.
California's groundwater situation is so complicated. And as we said earlier, it does feel very abstract. Why should SGMA matter to those of us not in ag?
Well, first, subsidence is putting all sorts of infrastructure at risk, canals, buildings, and roads. It is very gradual, so most of us are not aware it's happening, but the damage is likely to get worse if subsidence isn't reined in. And then drinking water is a matter of equity. You know, if groundwater levels aren't maintained, entire communities could see their wells go dry. Those are often in rural areas and communities of color. And even if the idea of equity isn't appealing, lost drinking water is a drain on public dollars. It's expensive for the state to provide bottled water or grants for new infrastructure. And of course, it's not just rural communities at risk. Even cities with deeper wells could face problems if water levels get critically low. Plus, equity is at risk among growers as well. Depending on who shakes out as a have or have not in the race to groundwater sustainability and access, many growers could be pushed out of business, and that could reshape the quantity and variety of commodities that we produce in our area.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for this reporting.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Tomorrow evening, 10 restored violins and one cello that survived the Holocaust will be played by the Fresno State Symphony Orchestra for a special concert, Violins of Hope. I spoke with the conductor, Thomas Loewenheim. He's a Fresno State professor of cello and director of the Symphony Orchestra and Strings. Loewenheim started the conversation by telling me about the personal connection he has to the violin maker who restored these historic instruments.
So Amnon Weinstein is the person who started the project, and his father, Moshe Weinstein, started the violin shop back in Tel Aviv in the beginning of the previous century. And what is interesting about the story is that my grandfather was a violinist and a violist, and he used to go to Amnon Weinstein's father. And then my mother was also a client of Amnon Weinstein. And then since I'm a young kid, I used to take my cello there for repair. And one of Amnon's specialties is that he can take any instrument and make it sound like a Strad. He's really amazing as a violin maker. So I've known Amnon Weinstein since I was a kid, and I consider him a close friend. We're still in touch all this time. And to make this project possible here in Fresno is just a dream come true of mine, because I was trying to do that for a very, very long time to get the violins here. And I'm just happy that Hilary Levine and Suzanne Rato were able to make that happen.
Well, tell me a little bit about these instruments and how he came to restore them.
So the answer is that I'm not 100% sure how it started, but I'm guessing that it started by people just coming to the shop with instruments that needed repair. And people just came in with whatever instrument they had. I mean, in the 1940s, there were so many immigrants. 1930s and 1940s, there were immigrants who came to Israel and brought their instruments that they used back in Europe. And several of those instruments then had all kinds of inscriptions and personal stories of the people that came to see Mr. Weinstein in Tel Aviv. And they said, I played this instrument in a concentration camp, or this instrument survived the Holocaust, or this instrument just survived World War II.
Well, tell us a little bit about what concert goers can expect Saturday night.
Concert goers can expect a wonderful experience this Saturday at the concert. We will have many aspects of the concert other than the performance. For example, Rabbi Rick Weiner from Temple Israel is going to come and light the Chanukiah, because right now it's Chanukah, the Jewish holiday of lighting the candles. And he will make the blessing and get everybody involved. We will also have Suzanne Rato come and speak. She is a Holocaust survivor herself, and she's heavily involved in the project. And she will come and talk about her experience and about her involvement with the project, talking about the violins. Suzanne will bring, I think, 10 or 12 violins and one cello that the students are going to perform on. And before the concert, they will be displayed in the lobby, and the students will perform on those instruments in the concert. In addition to that, the program for the concert is going to be Ben Chaim Fanfare. We'll have my colleague Limor Torin Immerman, who is an incredible violinist, perform two sets of pieces. One is the three pieces from Schindler's List by John Williams, and one is a suite called Baal Shem by Bloch. And then we will finish the concert with a piece by Paul Hindemith called Matthias de Mahler, the symphony, the symphonic version of Matthias de Mahler.
I would imagine it must be an incredibly emotional experience to play these instruments.
I think it's going to be very emotional. The students are not exactly sure what is coming to them, what to expect. And I think that once they see the instruments, once they hear a little about them, Suzanne is going to talk to the students before the rehearsal. Once they understand the significance, I think it will make their music making much, much more personal, much, much more emotional, much, much more meaningful. And that is, again, part of the whole idea of the concert. It's to bring, again, attention, to bring a memory to an event that we should all be thinking about and talking about, you know, World War II and its effect on society and what lessons we should have learned from that. And I think that doing it through art and doing it through music and doing it through artifacts that have survived such a horrible time and speak for themselves, so to say, I think is a wonderful message. It's an important message, especially in this time where our world is going a little bit crazy with politically and pandemically and all those events coming all together. I think that remembering and thinking about the lessons we can learn from history so we don't repeat them is a very important lesson. And doing it through music, doing it through nonverbal means as well as verbal means, I think is very effective and very powerful.
What really strikes me about this particular event is that these students are going to be holding history in their hands and using it to make incredible art, which, you know, we know is such a powerful way to touch into emotions and to bring history to life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that the pieces that we chose to demonstrate them, the fanfare is just a very beautiful opener. But the pieces for violin and orchestra that Dr. Torin Immermann is going to play with us, they're all very emotional. Of course, Schindler's List, the movie is so strong, talking again about the same subject. And the music by John Williams is very emotional and very personal. Bloch's Baal Shem, again, describing Hasidic life through the violin, through the music, is another great example. And Paul Hindemith's piece, it's not directly related, but I chose that piece because it's colors, it's a little bit modern, so the language used, you know, it was written about 10 years before World War II. The language used, the depth of the music and the power of the music is just so suiting to this concert, and I think that it will leave a strong impression on the audience.
You know, before I let you go, I just have to ask your thoughts about holding this event the same week that the university announced that it is forming a task force to discuss renaming the Henry Madden Library in light of the findings that Madden's writings contained anti-Semitic views and Nazi sympathies.
I was actually surprised to read that. I think that the coincidence between the two events is striking. I, of course, didn't plan on that because I didn't know about that. But I think that, like I mentioned earlier, I think in today's world where extreme ideas, you know, in every direction, it's not just anti-Semitism, but it's really going in our world is becoming more and more extreme. And personally, I feel that it's been driven by the media because it gets rankings. But for me, any extreme opinion is just unnecessary. I mean, I have a personal view that I've experienced now throughout my life, that I call it the 90%, where 90% of the people in the world, they just want to live in peace. They want to get up in the morning and go to work and live in peace with their neighbors, regardless of their religious, ethnic, color, etc. backgrounds. It really, for the 90% of us in the world, it doesn't matter. And then we have 5% on each side pulling really, really hard and influencing the rest of us and making our world a little bit, or not just a little bit, making our world not as pleasant. And I think that if we can take the lessons we learned from history, and I'll say that again because I think that throughout history we have evidence of things like that happening and what are the horrible results that can happen from extreme, any kind of an extreme opinion. And we should not go back there. We should be tolerant. We should be accepting. We should be loving each other. We should be able to work together. And one of the reasons that I'm a musician and one of the reasons that pushes me to do all the projects that I do is because my goal, my personal goal, is to bring world peace through music. And what music does so incredibly well is bring people together. The fact that it's a non-verbal language or non-verbal experience that and through orchestra, for example, we have, if you're going to look at the orchestra performing, the diversity within the orchestra itself is huge, and And all of them are sitting together, playing music, working towards a common goal, and drawing the audience into that same experience. I think music has this power that brings people together. And I think that we as a world have to start thinking, instead of how different we are and what makes one better than the other, to start thinking, how can we work together? How can we be together? Let's focus on our similarities rather than the differences. And let's remember what happened when we didn't. And how can we avoid any major catastrophes or major events that will affect all of us in the future?
Well, I've been talking with Dr. Thomas Loewenheim, professor of cello and director of the Symphony Orchestra and Strings at Fresno State, about the concert, Violins of Hope, Saturday at 8 p.m. in the concert hall on campus. Dr. Loewenheim, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. KVPR is one of six public radio stations nationwide chosen to partner this year with the Personal History Project StoryCorps on its One Small Step initiative. The idea is to bring together strangers with different political views to have personal conversations in an attempt to find common ground, or at least some shared humanity. In this segment, Barbara and Helen come together for a virtual conversation and quickly discover they have much more in common than not. They both spent time in Colombia as missionaries and were profoundly impacted by their experiences. Barbara extended her stay well beyond her one-year commitment, and Helen's politics shifted to the left upon returning to the U.S. They start their conversation by introducing each other.
Hello. My name is Barbara.
My name is Helen.
I'm talking from Fresno, California.
Barbara is my conversation partner.
We're going to get to know each other. Helen, she says, I am a Jesus follower. After college, taught elementary school in Cali, Colombia, then married and taught in Kinshasa, Congo.
Barbara says, I am a 79-year-old woman born and raised in New Jersey. Big positive events would include becoming a Christian and serving 21 years as a missionary in Bogota, Colombia.
We got a lot in common, don't we?
We do. Yeah. So you were in Bogota for all of those 21 years?
All of those 21 years. I went down for a year. But, you know, time takes a long time to pass.
Wow.
Helen, what made you want to do this interview today?
Well, I wanted to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. What made you want to do this interview today?
I thought it would be really fun to get to know somebody that was brand new and just show myself and show you and show whoever winds up listening to this that people can talk even when they don't agree on things.
Absolutely. I used to be a Republican because I came from Kansas and that's what my people were. But it seemed to me that during the past years, they have gotten very militaristic and capitalistic. So that's probably the main reason I usually vote Democratic.
I think I should call myself a Republicrat. I'm registered as a Republican, but I am deeply troubled by a lot of stuff that they're saying. And I'm troubled by some stuff the Democrats are saying. So maybe I'll just start my own party. Helen, is there something about my beliefs you don't agree with but still respect?
I guess your talk about the right to own a gun, that part I don't really agree with because I don't think guns are the answer to anything. Is there something that of my beliefs that you don't agree with but you respect?
Well, you mentioned immigration and I wondered, you didn't elaborate on that, and they'd be curious, because pretty much I feel we are on the same wavelength. I'm getting that sense, which is kind of nice.
We need to put way less money into military and policing and way more money into counselors and helpers at the border so that, I mean, we don't need a wall. We need people to know, to decide what to do for these immigrants and and negotiate together with Mexico and the Central American countries and see if we can help them get on the right track so people don't have to leave.
At the same time, I feel for the people, the North Americans who live on the border, and they don't feel safe in their own homes anymore because they never know who's going to be out in the yard when they go out there in the morning. Some of them are just struggling families trying to get through, and some of them aren't. Right now, we've got people in the United States who are unemployed because they don't want to work. And we've got these new people coming in who probably do want to work. And, you know, I'm glad I'm not in government.
Right. How would you like to be remembered? Like, I sometimes think about what I would like on my tombstone. And how would you like to be remembered, Barbara?
I would like to be remembered as somebody who loved God. Yeah. I want to be remembered as somebody who made God smile, who loved God. How about you?
I would like to be remembered for being a loving grandma and one that and a person who loved the Lord and served him. What a special time this has been.
This has been wonderful.
This has been so super. I want to get to know you better, Barbara. Is that
yes.
a possibility?
We're happy yes. to report that One Small Step conversation partners, Barbara and Helen, did in fact meet up in person. And they told us they could have talked for hours. And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Mathi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.